Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. I'm very pleased today to welcome Tim Jackson to the podcast. Tim is Professor of Sustainable Development at the University of Surrey and Director of the Centre for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity, which builds on his 30 years of multidisciplinary research on sustainability and decades of policy experience, in particular his work as Economics Commissioner on the UK Sustainable Development Commission. Tim is the author of Prosperity Without Growth, a seminal text that challenges conventional economic wisdom of endless economic growth on a finite planet. So thank you very much, Tim, for taking the time today to speak to the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Yeah, pleasure, Fergal. Glad to be here.
Great. Maybe before we begin, perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about your background and what you do at the moment.
So I guess our sort of overarching question, if you like, is a very simple one. What can prosperity possibly look like in a world of environmental and social limits? And it's about what makes for the good life on the one hand, but it's also about living on a finite planet on the other hand. And sometimes those two things don't entirely go together, because in the process of living a good life, we consume lots of resources. And if we're not too careful, we trash the planet. Climate change, deforestation, the loss of species, the human expansion, the relentless growth of the economy. And that was our model of what prosperity should be for quite a long time. And it's kind of coming to the end of its usefulness. So our job really is to think of prosperity differently, think of what it might mean instead, and to develop the tools and the policies and the institutions that might further that idea of a sustainable, a lasting prosperity.
That's fascinating. I think many people have criticized over the years people who are concerned about the environment or the limits of the economy by not having a positive vision of what an economy or world would look like, rather than the more negative and dystopian visions. Just before we go into some of the work you've been doing, I'm just wondering, could you maybe rank what you think are a few of the biggest sustainability challenges we're facing, and how big you think they
are? Well,
we could talk about that for a long time, but
the one that's obviously the most well known, I suppose, is the climate change challenge, and the idea that we should try and limit the warming of the atmosphere to 1.5 degrees above what it was before we started out on all this industrial stuff. That was an aspirational agreement by pretty much every nation in the world at the time in Paris a couple of years ago. And when you look at what that means, limiting the global warming to 1.5 degrees, it turns out you basically have to get rid of all carbon going into the atmosphere, effectively all carbon going into the atmosphere by a couple of decades at the most. And that's extraordinary, because our entire civilization really has been built around putting carbon into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels. And that, so essentially we have to not just stop burning fossil fuels, we actually have to start capturing carbon out of the atmosphere somehow. So that's a big challenge. And you could argue, well, we're not going to get to 1.5 degrees. That's possible. We won't. Could we limit it to 2 degrees? That's already a pretty dystopian world. It's a tricky place to be. 3 and 4 degrees, you're looking at, a world that is potentially radically different from the one that we have known for centuries. And so, that is definitely a biggie. In terms of what it means for changing society and doing things differently. I think there's also, there's other couple of big ones as well. I mean, I would say really, the attack, if you like, you could almost call it that, the attack on other species who share the planet with us has kind of reached proportions that, according to all historical, anthropological, biological evidence we haven't seen for millennia, the rate at which species are being lost, largely because of the impact of human activity on their habitats and on their way of life. That's also a pretty scary thing. And you might think, well, you know, what did the nematode worm ever do for me? It kind of gave us our life and our livelihood in a way, because, you know, even the humblest of creatures are implicated in, for example, creating the soil from which we grow the crops to produce the food that we eat in order to live. So there's a moral point there. Is it right to trash all the other species who live on the planet? But there's also a kind of, you know, prudential point. Is it actually in our best interests to do that? So I would say those were the top concerns. I think there's also a resource concern, perhaps. You know, what happens when we run out of some of these critical resources that we need to make our iPhones work, for example, to make touch screens work, to keep electricity running through the pipes, to build our infrastructures and our architectures.
How much do you think of the problems that we're facing now can we lay at the feet of economic growth? I mean, the economy, the growth in carbon dioxide associated from, you know, post in the Industrial Revolution, growth in, you know, huge growth in the economy that we've seen in the last 100 years and more. Can you talk a little bit about the I guess double-edged sword that is economic growth?
Yes, I mean, you know, in some ways, economic growth has given us the lifestyles that we have at the moment. It's done enormous good in society. If you think about, you know, the transition from a sort of more or less peasant life to where we are today, and the quality of food, at least in principle, that we have access to, the quality of housing, the ability to keep ourselves warm. I mean, even in my lifetime, you know, the network of heating systems that heats our homes and keeps us comfortable is a sort of extraordinary transition when I think about it, even in personal terms. And it's done, you know, we've done wonders in medicine. We've got fantastic science. We've got endless choice. And all of those things were really made possible by this expansion of the possibilities for production, for creating stuff. And that in itself was made possible, of course, by the availability of high quality fuels, mainly fossil fuels. And so, you know, that's been very much a story of, you know, the success of science and the success of technology in delivering an improved quality of life. And I don't think it's ever right really to just entirely knock that and say, oh, we shouldn't have done that. We should have stayed, you know, back in the caves or out in the fields or whatever. That's not a very constructive place to be. I think it's right to acknowledge what progress we've made, but it's also right to recognize that progress has come at a bit of a price, and the price is very precise in relation to fossil fuels. If fossil fuels gave us all that, they also gave us carbon emissions, and that caused climate change. So that's our challenge, really. That our challenge is to come up with a sort of model of progress that doesn't continually sort of burn and use up and discard more stuff, and yet that gives us the kind of quality of life, the prosperity that we aspire to. And that actually poor countries, you know, many people in much poorer countries than we are still in the process of aspiring to reach a level, you know, even a fraction of the kind of quality of life that we have. So, you know, don't forget 2 billion people out there without, you know, access to secure clean water supplies or to secure electricity supplies. And that's basic things have gone missing in a quarter of the world's population. While, you know, the richest 1 billion or so have, if you like, almost a surfeit of stuff, a kind of affluenza that we're arguably living in a modern consumer society. So it's a challenge. It's not economic growth is not either unambiguously bad or simply good. it is, as you said, a double-edged sword.
Yes. And as you mentioned, the problems today still for such a large proportion of the planet, and indeed over the last, since China's economic reform, some 800 million, or I don't know what the figure, lifted out of poverty, according to the World Bank and so forth, which has obviously been, massive.
Now, can you talk about GDP, conventional measure of economic activity? I mean, how useful is that as a measure, particularly when we think about economic prosperity and well-being?
There's a wonderful quote about the GDP that's 50 years old, and it's that measures neither our wit nor our learning, neither our wisdom nor our courage, neither our passion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And that wasn't said by Robert Kennedy, and it's a sort of extraordinary testament to how long it takes for these things to kind of filter through, even when a visionary leading politician is able to see the writing on the wall. It's taken us half a century to understand actually that this GDP measure is not a particularly good measure of progress. What it measures is the busyness of the economy, how much we're producing, how much we're consuming, how much being traded, that kind of stuff element of our lives is pretty good at measuring that. But even in that case, it doesn't measure, for example, how fast things are wearing out. It doesn't measure the inequality in the access to those goods and services. It doesn't measure things that go on, really important things that go on outside the paid economy, like looking after our kids and taking care of our homes and of our elderly relatives. So all of that sits outside this wonderful measure of the busyness of the economy. And yet we chase that one single figure, that GDP number, as though it were, top place in the premiership or whatever. And it is almost like that. It's almost like a kind of schoolboy, school ground, and it often is boys, competition to be the best at a single number. And it's kind of pathological, really. I mean, I've been in meetings with senior Treasury officials who I've gone through this whole, idea that maybe the planet's finite, so our economic expansion might be limited. And they say, on one occasion, I remember going in and having this conversation about all this stuff, and they came out and said, well, so what's that going to be like when I turn up at the G20 and our GDP has slipped a notch? And it was as kind of basic as that, as, somehow status is linked to this one rather ineffective number, and that if that goes down, I'm not going to be seen up in the big boys ranking anymore. I'm going to be slipping down into some different place. But actually, the ranking never made any sense. There's no point in chasing a number if it's the wrong indicator. You can do something incredibly efficiently, but if it's the wrong thing to do, you still make your life worse. And that's the challenge, really, of this agenda, is that we've taken to measuring it for some very good reasons with an indicator that is basically flawed. And even though we knew that 50 years ago with Robert Kennedy, we haven't yet done enough to change it.
Yes. I spoke earlier in the series with Sabine Alcara at Oxford, who's done work around the multidimensional poverty index. And it's, I guess, another way of broadening out measures to take into account, things that matter when you come to looking at poverty. So is there a growing momentum to broaden the measure, to use other measures rather than GDP? And clearly it's tied in with national economies, but international economic organizations, the OECD and IMF and organizations like that. I mean, how do you see the lay of the land?
There is a movement to do that. I'm not sure that I would describe it as a growing momentum. It's had its phases of being more and less active. And so actually we've had, for example, the Human Development Index that the UN has measured for quite a long time, several decades. And in, you know, about a decade ago, there's a flurry of interest in different kinds of measurements. So President Sarkozy, as was then the president of France, put together a big commission headed up by international economists on what might need to be done. And some of that got rolled out afterwards, not just in France, actually, but in other countries as well. And then a few years ago, you know, we decided that it might be a good thing to measure national well-being in some other form, and so we put a bit of effort in the UK into kind of measuring life satisfaction in different kinds of ways, and all of these things help because they give you a bit of a better picture. I would say in a way that the multi-index multi-deprivation poverty indices have a really good view on things. In fact, my work on prosperity actually started and was kicked off by some kind of groundbreaking work on poverty back in the 1970s, where people who were working on poverty and researching it understand that poverty is not just an absence of money. It's an absence of access. It's an absence of community. It's an absence of the ability to be in the workplace. It's an absence of jobs. It's an absence of security in the family. It's an absence of a sense of meaning and purpose in life, which happens in the worst and the most deprived communities, that you have this kind of meaning. Not only don't you have a nice house to live in and a good car to drive and all the status symbols of modern society, but you're excluded from being an active participant in society, and that's a huge poverty. And the opposite of that, you know, the ability to participate in society, the ability to have access to community, all of these things that aren't really measurable by the GDP, these are good indicators of prosperity, and they're things that we can look at, we can quantify, we can actually come up with some relatively objective measures, or we can look at people's feelings and responses to them. All of these things, I think, are out there and they're being developed. At the moment, I would say we're in a little bit of a quiet place. I'm kind of hoping that the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's quote is going to kickstart a little bit more interest in it, because there was, I would say, more interest in that 10 years ago than there is at the moment.
Now, I guess the question of economic growth is deeply connected with economic development and poverty alleviation. We've seen tremendous economic growth in China in recent decades, for example, which seems to have lifted some 800 million or so Chinese out of poverty. Economic growth is clearly absolutely essential for the poorest countries in the world.
You know, it's really interesting to look at evidence in this kind of argument and to see actually where economic growth makes a difference. And it's very, very clear when you look at that evidence that in the poorest parts of the world, if you increase people's incomes, it doesn't just bring them out of narrowly defined poverty. It really does improve the quality of their lives. So you note, for example, that as incomes rise from virtually nothing to around about $10,000 or $15,000 per capita, that life expectancy more or less doubles over that rise. It really, you know, you improve health outcomes that much that life expectancy, you know, moves from the low 40s to the even to the 80s, and you get countries with an income quite a lot lower than the UK or the US or Ireland, and they have life expectancies that are equivalent to the kind of life expectancy we have in the most advanced countries in the world. But below that, as incomes get very low, life expectancy absolutely plummets. Same thing with infant mortality, the same thing with maternal morbidity, the same thing with education. You know, all of these indicators of success move very fast when you make very poor people a little bit richer. And then the graphs all show something really weird, which is all those gains start tailing off, they start diminishing. And in some cases, as I've said, you can find, you know, countries which are six times richer than the countries on the peak of that curve, with lower quality outcomes, or lower life expectancy in the UK than in Chile, for example, higher infant mortality in the US than in some countries in Eastern Europe, even. So there are these weird anomalies in the statistics which suggest that income growth matters up to a certain point, and then it begins to the advantages of it begin to diminish. And in fact, sometimes they diminish so far that you could be worse off in a richer country than you are in a poorer one in certain respects. And in the rich countries in particular, of course, some of that change in something like life expectancy is because of what's now being called lifestyle diseases, non-communicable diseases, not diseases that we catch something and then we die, but diseases which are about the factors, the lifestyle factors like diet and exercise and living conditions that reduce our vitality and make us more susceptible to cancer, to diabetes, to strokes, to heart disease, and so on and so forth. So those, you know, that's a real puzzle. It sort of does suggest that we've kind of gone past the point, and we need to somehow find our way back into balance with those things that contribute real quality of life, real prosperity.
So clearly, the massive economic growth we've seen, particularly in recent decades, have had a significant impact, negative impact on the environment, many of the environmental boundaries and so forth. Now, many people, while worrying about these issues, are optimistic that we can have some kind of green growth. What's your view?
Green growth. So what is the green growth? I like to think of green growth as really we can have our cake and still eat it. You know, we can eat our cake and still have it. We can have eaten all the goodies in the world, and yet we can still achieve this wonderful outcome of a planet that's livable and habitable for future generations. It's a very much, you know, have kind of philosophy, and it's very attractive for that reason, because it sort of says, you know, we don't have to do anything about the existing economic structure, that we don't have to worry about not having growth anymore. We can all have the best possible access to all the goods that we might want, and yet we can become so clever technologically that we can remove all the danger, all the environmental impact from that. So we can decarbonize our electricity system, we can dematerialize our production system, we can recycle all our consumer waste, we can do everything that we need, in other words, to clean up the kind of vision that we have of this growth-based economy and turn it into a clean growth, smart growth, sustainable growth, green growth. You know, if I had a dollar for every aphorism around a clean growth model, then I'd be a very rich man. But it's seductive, you know. It's kind of, we don't have to mess too much, guys. All we have to do is be as clever as we already are and use technology to get ourselves out of the mess. And It appeals not only to the sort of the status quo in terms of keeping the economic institutions and the economic power structures in place that already exist, but it also appeals to our idea that we're a very clever species. And there's no doubt, I'm not questioning that we are a very clever species. I'm just wondering whether we're clever enough, or in fact, actually, whether in some cases the scientific rules of the game will prevent us from being clever enough to solve all of these problems. So you can do a lot with technology, but you still live on a planet in which the laws of thermodynamics exist and constrain what's possible to achieve. And that possibility of what we can achieve is where, again, you have to look at the data and you have to say, yes, have we been clever enough to reduce our environmental impact so far? Well, we have done it unit for unit. So our efficiency in delivering, for example, energy has improved enormously since the Industrial Revolution, probably about 300-fold. And that's, you know, incredible, except that, of course, our output, our scale, has also increased around about the same amount. And actually, we're not yet on a winning wicket. Our improvement is not outrunning the scale at which economic growth, the speed at which economic growth is growing, the scale of our economies. So our economies get bigger and bigger. We get more efficient at using resources in them, but we don't get efficient fast enough to overcome the impact of the expansion of our economies. And in fact, sometimes making ourselves more efficient actually worsens the problem because it becomes cheaper and easier to do stuff. So we do more of it. So we have, you know, a rebound effect from being efficient that means that we end up polluting the planet even more. And that's a really tricky place to be in. When you look at the evidence, you can see that it's writ large across all of the evidence over the last half a century. That's basically the story, that we got more efficient, but we did masses more stuff, and therefore scale outweighed efficiency. It doesn't altogether rule out what the green growth protagonists say they want, which is to do better in the future. And of course, we could do better. We could figure out all sorts of lovely ways to do better. I mean, I've done the numbers on this several times. In particular, quite recently for the second edition of Prosperity Without Growth, when I published it last year. And what struck me between the first time that I published it, which was almost 10 years ago, and the second edition published last year, is that the task of running fast enough, of being technologically clever enough, has become harder over that period. We haven't, in the meantime, in that decade, we didn't show ourselves to be more clever, more technologically efficient, and more adept at reducing our environmental problems. Actually, the opposite is the case. In other words, we should never, ever be complacent about our technological ability to reduce the impact we're having on the planet. We have to judge that against the laws of thermodynamics on the one hand, you know, the laws of political institutions and how fast we move on the other hand, and then this cleverness that we prize so much in ourselves. And it's a form of hubris, really, to think we're so clever, we can always overcome those obstacles. We can't. We still live in a world in which the laws of thermodynamics have to hold, and we have to abide by those. We have to think very clear. We have to think a little critically, I would say, about this entire green growth narrative.
Now, I'd be interested just finally to get another big topic here. But, certainly in the last few decades, we've seen a very particular form of capitalist system, you know, with neoliberalism, which has run amok. Tied into that, clearly, is the role of the finance. How that needs to change, because that seems to be very much baked into or connected to this growth paradigm.
Yeah, it is. I think you know, you're right. It's huge, what we've done is we've kind of hardwired a financial system that institutionalizes profit maximization in ways that, you know, pay no real respect to the social costs or the environmental costs of that process. So we've got a financial system that kind of privatizes benefits, if you like, and socializes all the costs and risks associated with that. And that's a deeply unequal system, of course. It wouldn't be unequal if everybody had the same ownership of all the assets, if there was a kind of equal distribution of assets, but there clearly isn't. And what happens, therefore, is the concentration is that the system itself, the architecture of the system, tends to concentrate wealth, to drive the system harder. And then when the social costs come along, actually, even like the financial crisis was a social cost of a system that was basically unstable, and it was paid essentially by governments, by taxpayers, who bailed out the financial sector, who expanded the national debt, and who kept the system on the road, on the rails, by paying, essentially, and by future generations paying for the risks and the costs of those risks that had been generated by an unstable financial system. So that's huge. But and it is, you know, there's the beginnings of a realization of that, and it's you can see in that either depending on your degree of pessimism or optimism, you can see a sort of, you know, this is the cracks in the shiny surface of capitalism and it's falling apart. Or you can see it as actually the place to really start thinking about what investment kind of means to us. Investment is our commitment to the future. It's our commitment to future prosperity. We don't just spend everything we have now. We lay aside a portion of our incomes. We save it. We put it into projects which last over time and will give us, or at least we hope that they will give us, a better quality of life in the future and lay down the foundations for the prosperity of our kids and their kids. And so there's an aspect of this which is really an opportunity to do something differently, particularly to do investment in the finance sector differently, but also to do our lives differently. And I think this is, you know, something I haven't really drawn out so far. We focused a lot on the kind of negatives, but actually there's a positive story here as well, particularly in countries where, you know, we're kind of overloaded with consumerism in a sense. We've spoken a lot about the kind of negative framing of the growth challenge, but there's also a positive framing in terms of our, you know, our own responses and our lives, and a sense in which, you know, particularly in a kind of over consumerist advanced economy, sometimes there are ways to, if you like, have more fun with less stuff, to live better by consuming less. And just a, you know, absolutely totally anecdotal example of that, which should probably be familiar to, you know, any parents out there. I remember when my kids were a little bit younger and taking them to a theme park. Now, it was a kind of ecological theme park because it had animals in it, and it was, you know, supposed to provide them with a kind of sense of understanding of the animal kingdom. So there was an educational aspect to it. But I remember this day really for a couple of reasons. One was that, you know, we were channeled through this theme park. We'd all paid our very expensive tickets at the beginning, channeled through the theme park, watched the snake eating a mouse and the bonobo monkeys doing what bonobo monkeys do. It's a little bit difficult to explain to kids actually why they're jumping on each other in quite the way that they are. And we'd done all this stuff, and then we were all again. And I began to notice at this stage how many fractious parents and screaming kids there were. And then we were all channeled out through this narrow funnel, which is called, you know, the reception area, but actually you don't get out until you've been through the shop that sells you the fluffy toys of all the animals that you've seen. And it's pure commercialism from beginning to end. And by the time we got out, I just swore I was never going to do that sort of thing with my kids again. And then I remember, and we'd spent a fortune on this. And even with all my principles, I couldn't really resist the plea of my kids for fluffy toys, which I obviously should have done. But then I remember that the second thing I remember is how the sense of relief, actually, the next day, we were all kind of a little bit frazzled by that experience and just thought, we're not going to do anything today. Let's go for a little walk on the hill outside. And we just, actually, they spent, I don't know, hours messing about by a stream, doing their own thing without any input from capitalism, from consumption, from consumerism, from the expectations that we have to grow the economy. In fact, we contributed nothing to the economy that day whatsoever, except for a little bit of food that we ate. And yet they were as happy as Larry. And that, to me, was a real object lesson in what's possible. I think consumerism has not just risked trashing the planet, has also risked kind of undermining our own creativity, our own sense of connection with nature, and indeed our own happiness sometimes. And there's a lesson in there that sometimes more is not always better.
Yes, absolutely. I've been there and had a similar experience. There's tremendous momentum on many fronts as well. You know, you talked about, there are grassroots organizations, there are commons-based organizations, there is quite a lot going on, even in the sphere of finance. There's ESG, there's impact investment, there's, you know, the head of the largest fund manager has sent a letter out, was it a few weeks ago, to companies saying that they needed to take into account, you know, the ESG factors and things like that. And I guess there's just, you could find lots of these seed beds of you know, inspiring change and so forth. Are you optimistic that, you know, I mean, clearly we're talking about something that's unfolding on, you know, we quite a long time frame, and yet we've clearly got, you know, quite a narrow window as well. As you say, 1.5, even 2, even, you know, getting to beyond that, which we don't really want to think about. But I'm just wondering, are there a few things that make you optimistic that we will that there's a new paradigm really emerging, or that we will, you know, be able to create some substantive change and reorientate ourselves?
Yeah, I think it's always actually, you know, not exactly a moral obligation, but it's definitely a good idea to be optimistic. You know, if you, there's a certain paralysis that sets in when you think we're all doomed and the system's broken. And the system may be broken, but actually, you know, this is where actually our ingenuity and our creativity comes to the fore. And as you say, there are lots of those initiatives, particularly in the financial sector, because the financial sector was so clearly dysfunctional and was shown to be dysfunctional 10 years ago through the crisis, and has certainly not delivered on our need to invest in the future in the way that we've been talking about. So it's really heartening to see the amount that's going on there. The high level expert group in the European Commission on sustainable finance, for example, just launched its report back in January, an ongoing process to implement the recommendations of that report. I've advised over the last 10 years, I've advised companies and organizations in the financial sector, and I know for a fact that there are very, very good people, you know, bright, highly motivated, committed people working on change in those organizations. Is it happening fast enough? Clearly at the moment not, but change of that kind isn't sort of linear anyway. It's not incremental in that sense that, you know, we make one step forward, another step forward, another step forward. Sometimes you make two steps forward, one step back, and sometimes the change actually moves very, very fast indeed. And we should never rule out that possibility. I think optimism is a kind of, it's a job requirement in terms of thinking clearly about social progress.
Absolutely, absolutely. What's on your agenda now, Tim? What? Where's your focus of research? What are a few of the things that you're exploring?
Well, we're exploring, and I run a research centre, the Centre for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity, and we're actually exploring, you know, across that spectrum of things that we've spoken about. So, on the one hand, we're exploring the vision. What is it that people aspire to? What does prosperity mean to them? And how can we, you know, find these ways as individuals, as communities, as a society, to have more fun with less stuff, to have a less consumptive life that is equally or perhaps even more satisfying to us? And that's, you know, that's the work of sociology and psychology and anthropology. It's a social science work. And then we've also got to figure out, of course, how to deliver the economy that could achieve that. And so there's a sort of harder, if you like, more quantitative bit of work around modeling the economics of that, figuring out how an economy works when it's just not relentlessly consuming stuff and expanding year on year. Is there a sustainable economy out there? Is there an economy fit for purpose? And that's that's an absolutely essential task. And what's extraordinary is that there aren't that many people doing it at the moment, but it's the task that will define whether we're successful in making this transition or not. So we're putting quite a lot of effort into that. And the striking thing to me, and it's a very gratifying thing, is how a younger generation of researchers, of scientists, of economists is absolutely committed to that task. I have a wonderful team of people here in CUSP, and they are being driven by the energy of a restless younger generation who kind of sees actually that there's a better world out there and that they deserve to participate in creating it. So that's a very it's a humbling task in a way to be leading a group of people like that, but it's also extraordinarily encouraging. It's a very positive outlook that we carry here.
Very exciting work. I wish you the very best of success with it all. And thank you for sharing all your insights today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Yeah, pleasure, Fergal.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.